It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, you're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire, and today I am staging a coup. Yes, that's right, Matt Shawley is never coming back. Or is he? Today we're talking about that with an expert panel. How do you stage a coup just a couple of weeks after Niger experienced one of the latest coups in Africa? You don't want to miss that. It's a fascinating discussion of the history of coups and indeed the future of the African continent. But before all of that, it's time for the Economist panel.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, I'm joined by Manveen Rana, host of the Stories of Our Times podcast. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
And today's someone called Matthew. That Matthew is Matthew Bell. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Patrick. Hi, how are you?
Great. Very good. Very good, thank you. I'm well. And I don't think we've ever spoken before, so welcome.
We haven't. Well done for toppling Matt. You've done a great job.
I know. Let's see. I might subject myself to a democratic election once the transition is complete. I'm not sure. I'm confident I win it, though. Let's get straight into it, shall we? Front page of this morning's Times, Rishi Sunak pledging Britons will be better off next year. He wants to maintain discipline on public spending and tax. He thinks the plan is working, Manveen, his economic plan, and inflation did fall yesterday for the second month in a row. But do you think voters are going to feel it?
No. I mean, it's sort of, it had the feeling of somebody in number 10 had clearly said to him, you need to be a little bit more boosterish. You know, that's how Boris Johnson did it. It made people feel a bit better, go out and be boosterish. And he's sort of saying the right things if you're just reading the script, but I'm not sure anyone's buying them. You know, inflation did fall a bit, but I'm not sure most people have really noticed that. You know, their weekly shopping bill is still very high. Wages are slowly edging up to try and compensate for that. But, you know, I don't think anyone feels any great confidence about where they'll be in a year's time. And I also thought it was sort of, you know, he's made exactly this promise before and not met it. Inflation is something he can try and control, but not very effectively. You know, we don't know what will happen with the war in Ukraine. We don't know if energy prices, where they'll be in a year's time, if the grain exports keep getting stuck, we don't know what will happen to food and food price inflation. Mm. You know, there's so much that he can't really control. So it just feels like sort of a slightly hollow, empty, boosterish but meaningless promise.
Boosterish but meaningless. That's pretty harsh, Manveen. Matthew, what do you think? Do you think the Prime Minister's talking about relaunching himself, resetting himself in September? What do you make of that? Does he need to?
Well, I think the timing of this interview is all we need to know about. It's, you know, why has he chosen today to give an interview to the Times? It's because there's been the first glimmer of good news, the first nugget of anything remotely good happening for him. And so he's able to say,
look, taken a while.
Exactly. But, you know, had he done it last week, what would we be talking about? We'd be talking about the barge off Dorset. We'd be talking about the other pledges that aren't working. But, you know, this, he's clinging on, and his pledge was to halve inflation. Well, this, he hasn't halved inflation. There's been, I think, 2 months where inflation has come down by a percentage point, but it's expected to go back up again next month, and they know that already. So it's very political of him, and that's what we're seeing from Rishi Sunak. Is, I was very hopeful when he first came in, because he's clearly a much more competent and the right prime minister than the last two conservative prime ministers we've had. But on the other hand, he's just far too political, and all he seems to be thinking about is the next day, the next week. He's not looking at the broader picture, and he's got a golden opportunity until the election to get a lot of things done, a lot of interesting things done, but he doesn't seem to be taking that opportunity to do anything. He's really just clinging on to scraps of good news and good headlines when they come along.
Criticising a politician for being political is a bit rum, Matthew.
Well, he's being he's clinging on to a bit of good news, and that's fair enough. But he really should be launching more ambitious ideals than saying, look, the inflation's gone up by 1 percentage point this month. I mean, that's not great news, really. There's a lot more to be done.
More to be done, Manveen, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. And I also agree with the point that, you know, he's being very political. And I think actually it doesn't come naturally to him. So he's doing it really badly. And it just means that, you know, even in this interview, he points out the things about him, which I think made him quite refreshing. We thought, you know, could be quite hopeful as a politician, and that he has a hinterland. You know, he says he's the right person to be in charge of the economy, to be running the country at a time where technology is changing. And, you know, we know he spent years in America and working for Goldman Sachs and various bits of the financial system that, you know, look ahead to big changes like this. You know, there are skills and attributes that he has that he could be bringing to the job that would, you know, mean that he's looking at things differently. There's a bit of blue skies thinking. But actually, I think, as Matthew said, I think he's caught up in the day-to-day, what can I do that Labour isn't doing? So, you know, he ends up in this same interview sort of criticising Labour for their green pledges and sort of saying that they will endanger inflation and economic growth when, you know, as a man who worked in America a lot, you know, just looking at what America is doing with their Inflation Reduction Act, which has led to their economy doing much better, which is all about green subsidies. So it feels like he's probably not being very authentic to the things that he really believes either. You know, he's not looking at this in even the boring economist way, which is one of the things that we thought he would bring to the job, because he's trying to be political and just not doing it very well.
Well, what's the Rishi Sunak you expected then? Because I think this is something people often get wrong about Rishi Sunak, the idea that he's a, you know, bland technocrat and not sort of... He is sort of intensely political. He's, you know, a sort of... I was going to say blue-blooded conservative. Blue-blooded means something a little bit different in our vernacular. But you know what I mean. He is a conviction Thatcherite,
yeah.
And I think his colleagues often forget that about him.
You know, I think he is. He's a conviction Thatcherite. He's a conviction Brexiteer. You know, all of those things I think we knew. But because he hadn't been in politics very long, I think there was sort of a sense that this is a man who isn't a natural politician. What he's bringing to the job, hopefully. You know, certainly when he sort of first appeared miraculously as Chancellor, he sort of thought he's bringing the skills of the outside world. He's bringing sort of a level of competence and a decision making process which will be influenced by bigger thoughts about the economy rather than about politics. And I think that's where things are going wrong.
But surely people will thank him. He's not doing
the Goldman Sachs sort of thinking about, well, you know, in the interview, he talks about technology and how the economy should be changing. And yet that's not how he's running government or how he's even running these interviews. You know, he's still sort of using it to snipe at Labour over and you know, the things he's been saying about green energy and putting sort of some of that on a back burner, I think is, you know, not playing very well with the electorate, but also it just sort of seems economically as the big sort of Goldman Sachs, what is the future, what's the economic vision, I'm not sure it really washes.
But anyone in his position would be seeking to tell a story about his leadership and snipe at the opposition. I think, isn't that just shrewd politics from Rishi Sunak? Or is your objection that it doesn't sound prime ministerial or convincing?
I don't think it sounds convincing. I think you sort of, you know, that's fine. And then you get to the end of the sentence and think, but what does that mean? You know, he's promising he'll lower inflation and increase economic growth by next year. No sense of how. And, you know, lowering inflation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to boost economic growth. And he hasn't explained what his big sort of growth policy is. He's sniping at the one thing, you know, Labour's... I mean, I don't know how committed Labour is to this policy either, to be honest. So, you know, I'm not sort of saying Labour will get it any better. But the one thing that America has managed to use in order to both lower inflation and aid the economy, he's sort of pointing out as a mistake. So I feel like it's not very consistent. I don't really know what he believes apart from the... things will be better next year, but I just don't know how we get there. I think that's the problem. It's not very convincing.
Speaking of the economy, Matthew, we're going to look at some really interesting data. The UK is seeing its cohort of millionaires fall from 2.99 million to 2.56 million in 2022. That's 4.3% though, of the entire country. We're sixth in the leaderboard worldwide at four millionaires, according to research done by the bank UBS. The findings have outraged many people on the left in France. But how do you think they'll go down here? I mean, being a millionaire, you know, that famous aspiration of Del Boy and Rodney, this time next year we'll be millionaires. How do you think people will look at these figures here?
Well, of course, we all want to be millionaires. But I think the first thing to say about this data, just before we go any further, is that it's millionaires in terms of American dollars. Mm. So of course, but, you know, we must factor in the exchange rate. And part of this research has shown that now France has more millionaires than we do. So we sort of slipped down the millionaire rankings. But it makes me think of Peter Mandelson when I heard this news, who said, you know, of course, famously in the 90s, he was intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich.
As long as they paid their taxes, yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, the caveat we've all got to add at the end. It's like, of course, it's great to, you know, we all want to get really stinking rich, but we all have a duty to pay our taxes. And I think the bigger problem with Britain is that a lot of people are getting very rich and richer, but they're not paying their taxes because we've got such a it's a sort of complicated accounting system whereby it's very easy not to pay the tax that you owe. So, but tax is another subject. I think also when you look at these tables of data, I think you need to look at the other end and look at the poverty index and how many people are there in Britain getting poorer. So we've got to look at the figures both from both angles, I think. But of course we all want to get really rich. So that's great news. But let's not get carried away, I suppose.
Yeah, what does it say that our share of millionaires is falling, Manveen?
Well, I mean, actually, like Matthew, I did suddenly think of the tax, because I sort of wonder if you had... if you sort of were able to level that table for tax policies in each country, whether you'd get a different result, because these presumably are declared millionaires. And I wonder if actually sort of like the tax system in some countries means that you've probably got more millionaires than are necessarily public. But, you know, I'd sort of think, again, like Matthew, I think actually a lot of it comes down to the range of how much people are earning in a country. You don't want it to be wildly out of kilter. You know, it's great having lots of millionaires because you hope, as Liz trusted, that there will be a trickle-down effect. But if the people at the bottom of the scale aren't getting any richer, then, you know, actually things are just going to, you know, the property prices will go up in an unaffordable way. You know, it sort of has a terrible effect on people who can't afford to get along. I thought it was interesting that sort of with this table, you know, France has come out as number three, and actually it seems to have led to a real public debate in France whether this is a good thing. they seem very anti.
You know, sort of it's a cornerstone of French identity, sort of equality, you know, post-revolutionary. That post-revolutionary politics, interesting, obviously we never had a violent revolution in this country. And you know, Macron is, not yet. We are doing a big thing at 11 o'clock on how to stage a coup. So,
in that case, it's in the offing.
Well, indeed, maybe people will get ideas. But, you know, as you were saying, Emmanuel Macron has long been criticised for being a president of the rich. You know, you see him, breaking bread with Elton John on the night. Riots are happening in the banlieue. So, yeah, it's very interesting. Right. That's quite enough about millionaires. Or indeed, let's talk about a different kind of millionaire and footballers. I don't know if either of you caught the football yesterday, but where do you stand on Keir Starmer's suggestion of a bank holiday if we win the World Cup on Sunday?
Well, it's a genius political move, because who's going to argue against him? And to say no.
The Treasury might. They hate bank holidays.
Well, that's true. And it looks like the Tories aren't going to, they're not going to cave. They're not going to give us a bank holiday. And in fact, they have never done, the government has never given a bank holiday for a sporting event. So it's interesting that they only give us extra bank holidays for royal events, like the royal wedding in 2011 and the Queen's Jubilee. But of course, you know, if you're in opposition, you've got to say we've got to have a bank holiday. And actually, I do actually think, you know, it's an important moment for women's sport. So if ever you're going to give a bank holiday for a sporting event, which they didn't for the Ashes, they didn't for so many other things when, you know, there's been calls for a bank holiday. If you're going to do it, the time to do it is when a women's team is winning an international tournament as huge as the World Cup. And it is incredible. It's completely unbelievable that this Sunday we might actually win the World Cup. You know, England has not won a World Cup since 1966. It's huge news. And yet part of me thinks, well, I mean, personally, I hate bank holidays because I don't have a job. So it doesn't mean anything to me whether I have it's another day of not earning money.
But this is hard work, Matthew.
But the people around you are a bit happier.
Yes. Exactly, exactly. But it is bad for the economy. You know, they crunch the numbers and it looks like the economy always suffers by half a percentage point because, you know, you've got a cafe next to an office. Well, you're not open, you're not making money. So it's not great for everyone, a bank holiday. And also there are other ways of celebrating sporting victories other than going getting pissed on a Monday and then having a hangover on a Tuesday. But
Are you prepared to argue against that, Manveen?
Well, I think it would be great to have a bank holiday because, you know, I know we've had successes with the Ashes, but they, you know, they come around much more often. Whereas in 1966, and this is the Lionesses, we know that female football has sort of been suppressed in this country. You know, we know that they were, the FA stopped
them
playing.
Well, it's banned for decades and decades.
That's
what
I mean. So, you know, actually, so it would feel like a good, you know, emotionally, it feels like sort of a good time to repay a historical injustice. You know, it sort of feels like it which should be celebrated. There should be a big national moment and a bank holiday seems like a good one. On the economy, I just have to say, I think, you know, people wheel out these figures from about 10 years ago. Somebody did a study saying it costs more than $1 billion or $2 billion every time we have a bank holiday. But I think actually that's been challenged quite a lot because, you know, we have fewer bank holidays in this country than the rest of Europe. And yet our productivity is lower in this country than the rest of Europe. You know, and there is an argument that this actually sort of boosts productivity in the long term. There's also sort of a question of, you know, if you have a bank holiday on a Friday, apparently it costs the economy less. So there are ways around it.
That's really interesting.
I sort of think it's worth us sort of reassessing. It feels like it's something we always assume, but it's worth us looking at it again because it's very hard to properly quantify. You know, we know that although businesses are closed, people go out much more on bank holidays. You know, there are sort of boosts to the economy too. So it's probably worth somebody somewhere doing another study again to work out just you know, whether actually we should be having more bank holidays full stop.
It's interesting
I think
you
we have about eight and the rest of Europe has about 11. So, you know, we've got space there for at least another three.
quite possibly. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the productivity piece. It was interesting. In those economic figures we were talking about yesterday, productivity was only up 0.1%. So that's a sort of missing piece of the puzzle. Right. We're talking about politicians, football, how they should respond to the Lionesses' victory yesterday and final on Sunday. Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, certainly tried yesterday. He posted a picture of himself enjoying the football, so to speak, in what is clearly a staged photo and not a candid moment. Ed Davey is standing around a small pub table with a pint, with a clenched fist to demonstrate his passion, his very authentic passion. And he's not the first politician, of course, to show off their football watching credentials. Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer, Sir Lindsay Hoyle and many, many more have all been guilty of this sort of thing. Jack Hill, the Times chief news photographer, may have even captured a few of them in the act. How are you, Jack?
Morning, Patrick. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Great to have you. I mean, I just need to get your photographer's assessment of Ed Davey's moment in the pub yesterday. Where does that rank in the, you know, in the obviously staged pictures you've seen of people watching football over the years?
Well, as you're aware, there's a long history of these things. I mean, the picture is quite funny from yesterday. But the politicians have been doing it for a while. I mean, we see Rishi Sunak did it, I think, in the Euros final, as did Keir Starmer. I mean, I think, you know, as these things are sort of attempts to connect with the sort of common man and woman who make up the majority of this country. And they try to do it, but I think you can see through the inauthenticity of them. So in some ways they backfire and look slightly creepy. But that's my take on it.
Talk us through the sort of choreography of doing, you know, of sort of posing one of these shots. Would the photographer have been in front of Ed Davey saying, go on, give us a cheer, Ed, that sort of thing?
I was talking to the picture editor about it this morning because I wondered where the picture had come from, because sometimes they come from pool events where one of us might be at to photograph and share the pictures with the rest of the press. This looks like it was taken by one of his own people purely for his Twitter feed. And I can imagine, as you described, someone has stood in front and said, look, let's recreate the goal. All look at the screen and cheer as if there's been a goal. And obviously Ed Davey does it with some faux enthusiasm, whereas everyone else sort of looks slightly bemused. It was obviously early, but there's only two drinks on the table as well, and no one else in the pub.
Yeah, no one else in the pub. That's the funny thing. He tried manfully. You've got a lovely picture of another politician in the Times today. Lovely portrait of Rishi Sunak on the train to Leicester. You know, he's got his file in front of him, takeaway coffee, half-eaten sandwiches. How is he to photograph? You've photographed him a few times now. How is he as a sort of subject?
I think, you know, he's a good subject. I mean, I think what we find now is that the politicians, the senior politicians, are extremely aware and sensitive to how they're seen visually and want to be seen well. I mean, if just looking at the numbers of photographers there are now in Whitehall and Downing Street tells you how important they see it. He's a good subject. He's obviously a busy man. The things on the table in front of him weren't props. He did bring that piece of cake. It was a piece of cake that he bought.
Ah, it's not a sandwich.
He's got a bit of a sweet tooth, and he every time I photographed him, he's got a cup of something and a sweet pastry beside him. But he's good, but he was busy. He wanted to prepare for this PM Connect event in Leicester. And I don't know if you saw the picture that was in the paper.
Yeah,
well,
he's sort of looking very happy, like, you know, and at ease, which is not something you often see prime ministers under pressure looking like. Thank you very much, Jack Hill, chief news photographer of The Times, and to Manveen Rana and Matthew Bell, today's columnist panel. Don't go anywhere, because we're going to stage a coup shortly.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Want truly hydrated skin? Meet Osea's Body Care Breakthrough, Hyaluronic Body Serum. It's clinically proven to increase hydration by 161%. It's lightweight, fast-absorbing, and delivers 24 hours of hydration for silky smooth skin without any sticky afterfeel. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code SUMMER.
You're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Now we're staging a coup.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
And we're talking about how to stage a coup d'etat. That is an illegal attempt to overthrow a government. How does one stage a coup? And why would one stage a coup? Now, I should clarify, I'm not planning on taking over Matt Chorley's show while he is away. But we have noticed that coups are becoming much more frequent. Niger is just the latest African nation to see its leaders deposed by the military. 13% of African countries have seen coup attempts between 2020 and 2022. That's a six-fold increase from just 4 years earlier. And that led the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to declare that military coups are back. So today we're going to find out how and why a coup comes about. And we're going to start in that very continent of Africa with the Times Africa correspondent Jane Flanagan, who's been following the most recent coup in Niger. Hello, Jane.
Hi, Patrick.
So what motivated that coup we saw just a couple of weeks ago in Niger?
Well, it does have the hallmarks of just a very old-fashioned palace push rather than any sort of ideological motive emerging. It appears, though, General Tchiani, who was the head of the presidential guard and actually with the task of being alert to these sort of threats, was at risk of being removed from his post and decided to maneuver against President Bazoum and got colleagues together and they barricaded him into the presidential palace there and declared themselves the new leaders of Niger. I mean, they have blamed the worsening insurgency and economic mismanagement for the power grab. But actually, Niger had done much better than its neighbours in battling jihadist extremists. And so it does seem that actually the motivation was that he didn't want to be out of a job.
And what was the reaction within Niger from its people?
Well, there has been some evidence of support for the new junta. I mean, they did fill a football stadium shortly after the general declared himself the new ruler. But it's quite easy to get some anti-French feeling going on and blame the international community for the problems of Niger. And we've seen that coup leaders across Africa in the former French colonies are very successful in doing this, presenting Bazoum as a puppet of the West and blaming that for keeping people in poverty and so on.
So where is Bazoum? Has he been sent to prison or is he in exile?
No, he's still at the presidential palace now. He's been there for 3 weeks. He's been held with his wife and his son. We understand in very difficult conditions, food supplies are dwindling, the power cuts because Nigeria is part of a regional sanction as cut off power to Niger. He has refused to resign, and the junta have now said they're going to try him for high treason, for undermining the security of the country, because he's been in touch with regional heads of state and also the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. It does seem to me to be quite odd that the UN and President Biden have expressed concerns for his well-being because of the conditions in which he's being held. But at the same time, he seems to have had access to his mobile phone to make all these calls and even file an op-ed to the Washington Post warning of the dire international consequences for this coup. So it does seem quite odd conditions in which he's being held.
So you talk about international opprobrium. Is this coup likely to be reversed either internally or with foreign intervention?
Well, I mean, for quite a sort of ragtag bunch, they've dug in and, you know, appointed a new cabinet. They've managed to cling on now for 3 weeks. And there is a limited window when power grabs like this can be reversed. And at the moment, they've resisted, you know, threats of military action, threat of having aid cut. Nigeria and the ECOWAS economic bloc there in West Africa have already imposed quite harsh sanctions. But at the moment, they just seem absolutely to be humbling all the pressures that that can be brought to bear on them.
And this is the fifth coup in Niger since its independence from France in 1960, but it's its first since 2010. We were just talking about the number of African states that have seen coups in recent years. Do you think this is becoming something of an epidemic?
Well, certainly, you know, coups seem to come in waves, and at the moment there does seem to be a sort of contagion. And this explains why the regional leaders in West Africa have taken such a hard stance, threatening military intervention, which is unusual for them, because I think they're feeling very nervous about their own positions. You only have to look at a map of Africa and the coup belt across its widest point from Sudan in the east to Guinea in the far west. Niger was the missing piece, really, in now connecting this corridor. So I think, yes, I think they've got every reason, the countries in that area, all the leaders, to feel very nervous about what their military are thinking about this.
Thanks very much, Jane. That was Jane Flanagan, Africa correspondent at The Times. And now, Jane was explaining there what exactly is a coup. Now, someone who knows an awful lot more about this is Dr. Mawita Chacha, Assistant Professor in International Relations at the University of Birmingham, and Michael Binion, veteran correspondent for The Times, who joins me in the studio. Mawita, let's start with you. Define for us, in the simplest possible terms, what exactly is a coup, and does what's happened in Niger follow that traditional playbook?
Well, thank you for having me on your show. So when we think about a coup, we're thinking of an illegal power grab usually done by the armed forces or other political elites. And what coups aim to do is to unseat the incumbent president, or in this case, the incumbent government, and replace it with another. And there's usually a discussion or a debate as to what counts as a successful coup. Does it mean that the coup should, or the coup perpetrator should have held power by, for a week or for a month? But I mean, that's irrelevant in this particular situation, because at the end of the day, what we are observing in the case of Niger is that the head of the presidential guard, Tchiani, who happened to be part of the elite, replaced or chose to oust the incumbent president, Mohamed Bazoum. So you see the same trajectory where it's an illegal power grab. And the aim is to replace this incumbent with another leader, another person as being the leader of Niger.
Michael Binion, in your 50 years at The Times, you've covered and written about many a coup. How does Niger compare, do you think?
Well, it's a classic African pattern, and I'm afraid just nearby we see the prime example of coups, which is Nigeria, which is potentially a very rich, prosperous country, which has basically been held back for years by endless attempts to manoeuvre and oust the government. They've had five successful coups, military coups, three unsuccessful ones. They've had a military government for 33 years, between 66 and 99. We're only now entering into a period of relative stability and peaceful democratic government. But some of the coups have been very bloody. Some have led to the installment of people who were frankly dreadful dictators. Sani Abacha was probably the worst and the last one. Nigeria is one of many countries in the region, but I've also seen coups elsewhere. I suppose the most spectacular one I covered partly was one that didn't go well at all, which was the attempt to oust Gorbachev.
Well, we'll speak about that in just a moment. I really look forward to your memories of that. But Moeta, you've picked out three of the coups that have had the biggest impact on world history, in your view. Let's start in Czechoslovakia in February 1948. Talk us through what happened there. And in fact, we can hear a clip of what happened there.
Terror has already been unleashed in its full fury in Czechoslovakia and will be greater than in the countries of Eastern Europe, because it will be all the more difficult, if not impossible, for a truly democratic people to become accustomed to slavery.
Talk us through this one, Moeta.
So what happened here was the Soviet-backed Czechoslovak Communist Party took over power. And this was a time, as some of us may recall, was the early phase of the Cold War, and the US was considering how to go about dealing with the Soviet Union, how to go about rebuilding Europe. And so this coup happens in Czechoslovakia, and we see in the US an increased, you could say, support for the Marshall Plan, the plan to aid the recovery of Europe. Because at the time, prior to this coup, some in the US Congress were a bit hesitant as to whether this amount of money should go to aid Europe or not. But then the coup happens, and the tensions between the US and the Soviet Union are heightened, and there's this increased support for the Marshall Plan. At the same time, I think that those who could link the Czechoslovakia coup with increased support and increased resolve to establish NATO, which we see being established in 1949, a year after this February 1948 coup.
Why was this such a significant moment in the history of post-war Europe, Michael?
Well, because it showed that the Soviet Union had total dominance over all Eastern Europe, all the places they had liberated from Nazi Germany, but where they remained with their forces. And it was simply implementing Stalin's view that there should be total Soviet control and a buffer zone over the Soviet Union's neighbours. So the whole of the Warsaw Pact, as it then became, was communist. And in fact, it then was clear that no country, having become communist, would be allowed to revert from that state. So when Czechoslovakia, for example, tried to escape the clutches of the Soviet Union in 1968, there was an invasion, the same as happened in Hungary in 1956, and all Eastern Europe was essentially part of the Soviet Empire.
Very, very interesting and consequential indeed. Let's fast forward a couple of decades and head to Portugal in April 1974. Moeta, what are the key differences here?
I mean, the key difference here would be you could say, the consequence of the Czechoslovakia coup and the consequences of the Portugal coup in 74. Because in the Czechoslovak case, we see that the coup happens and authoritarian rule comes to dominate Czechoslovakia until almost the end of the Cold War. But then in Portugal, we see this coup actually taking out the authoritarian regime and ushering in Portugal's transition to democracy. But at the same time, there are other features that you could say distinguish this coup from the Portugal coup from the Czechoslovakia coup, because in the case of Portugal, we see a coup taking place within this broader context of decolonization in Africa and Southeast Asia, and the implications of that coup when it comes to what happens to Portugal's former colonies, Mozambique.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And then it has huge ramifications in Africa as well as in Portugal itself.
Exactly, exactly. So what happens is the coup happens in Portugal. The new regime in Portugal decides to leave Mozambique and Angola and the other Portuguese colonies. And in Mozambique and Angola particularly, we see this power struggle that emerges in these two countries, resulting in civil wars that end up attracting interventions from the US, the Soviet Union, Cuba, and South Africa. And so you have, you know, civil wars resulting from what happened in Portugal, attracting all these actors, all these key actors during the Cold War.
It's, you know, Michael, this was such a moment in the history of Western Europe. You know, Salazar had been in power from 1932, 1968, such a dominant figure, and his authoritarian regime. Obviously, he's out of office because of he's incapacitated by a stroke by 1968. But this, you know, it's such a huge moment, such a watershed moment for Europe.
It was wonderful. I was there. I reported it. I remember they overthrew Caetano, and it was led by an extremely unlikely coup leader, General Spinola, who was a monocle general of the old school. But he just realised that fighting the colonial wars in Mozambique and Angola forever and ever was never going to work, and that Portuguese forces were being drained. He took the decision to get rid of the fascist government, as it then was, and it was a good coup. People were rejoicing in the streets. It was also bloodless. Mm. There was almost nobody killed, certainly not within Portugal. There were soldiers with carnations in their rifles.
They called it the Carnation Revolution.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a summer of, yeah, it was a summer of chaos. Nobody quite knew what was happening. And the communists tried to take advantage of that to turn Portugal into a communist state. And there was a slightly precarious moment where the Communist Party of Portugal was making a key effort to dominate the political scene. But the Americans took a fairly firm line on that. And then it moved into a more democratic phase. And luckily, that coup, the good coup, as it were, was never reversed. Democracy took hold.
It's very interesting. You know, and it's not always an easy transition from a forceful taking of power to a stable democracy thereafter, is it?
No, very often it goes completely wrong. You often get either a counter coup or you get people in charge who say, oh, yes, yes, we're going to move to democracy, and they never do. And we've seen that, for example, in Sudan, where they got rid of Bashir, a nasty tyrant, and the military junta that took power said they were going to open it up to democracy. There was a brief period when they did. But they haven't. And in fact, what's happened is now we've got a civil war in Sudan as various rival military factions are vying for power.
Well, let's talk about some more surprising coups. Mawita, you picked out the Zimbabwean coup against Robert Mugabe in November 2017. Remind us of what happened there.
So what happens here is Robert Mugabe had been in power since 1980. And as many of us maybe aware, in the beginning, people thought this individual was truly committed to democracy. But then, as it turned out, this wasn't the case. And so what happens as he gets older is Mugabe begins to think about who would replace him. Mm. And so there's a faction within the ruling ZANU-PF, the Zimbabwean African National Union Party, that supported Mugabe's wife, Grace Mugabe, to take over power. Whereas there was another faction that actually was in favor of someone else. One of these other persons happened to be Mugabe's deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current vice president. Oh, sorry, the current president. At the time, he's vice president. And Mugabe, for whatever reason, decides to fire Mnangagwa. And within a week, Mnangagwa's supporters within the armed forces staged this coup. And they went out of their way, if you followed the events at the time, they went out of their way to not label this a coup, right? To try and talk about how this is a replacement, Mugabe is resigning. In fact, they went to court and had one of the courts in Zimbabwe rule that Mugabe, the ousting of Mugabe was actually legal. So you have these events taking place that somehow are surprising because, I mean, no one was expecting Mugabe to have lost control of the narrative.
Yeah, his control of Zimbabwe had been so total for so long, and that's why it was such a surprising moment. Michael, let's talk about another surprising coup, staying on the continent of Africa. What did Mark Thatcher, what did he get up to?
This was an extraordinary
one. Equatorial Guinea. Let's hear briefly from Mark Thatcher. Can we hear from Mark Thatcher?
I know you've all been in court for the last 3 days listening attentively to what's been going on. Having heard the arguments of both sides, I remain confident in the merits of the application that I've made, and I will await with interest and attentively for the judgment of the court.
What on earth went on here, Michael?
Well, this was an extraordinary thing. In fact, it pretty well followed that novel, The Dogs of War, which was about the overthrow of a government in a tiny, small West African country that at the time was impoverished, now turns out to be extremely rich. It was an attempt to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea, little tiny place, but subsequently proved to have masses of oil. And Mark Thatcher and various others were sponsoring an armed attempt. I mean, I have to say the government in Equatorial Guinea was rotten to the core, so it was ripe for toppling. And in fact, when they did, there was a coup, but it didn't work. And Mark Thatcher and various others were arrested. Well, certainly some of his associates. I don't think he was arrested at the time. It was plotted in South Africa. And several of them went to prison. They were imprisoned in Equatorial Guinea in not very nice circumstances at all. But the whole thing collapsed. And in the end, Equatorial Guinea, they had their own government, but Thatcher was deeply embarrassed by his association with these plotters.
And it just goes to show that often coups are driven from the outside by people with external interests in those countries. Can you just tell us briefly, Michael, before we take a short break, what it was like to be in Moscow in 1991 when, as you said earlier, Mikhail Gorbachev's, the coup against Mikhail Gorbachev failed?
Yes, I wasn't actually in there. I wasn't there at the time, but I had reported from outside. I'd been in Moscow for a long time before that. I subsequently returned after that, but I followed it very closely. And it was an extraordinary situation where the Soviet armed forces had always been utterly reliable and utterly subservient to the leadership. Gorbachev was on holiday in the Crimea, and a number of coup plotters, including the head of the KGB, as it then was, decided that he was losing his grip and that the Soviet Union was in danger of breaking up because he had promised various independence or autonomy to some of the various republics. And he was sort of trapped in his villa down on the Black Sea coast. Mm. And this lot took control, but they were utterly incompetent. They didn't know what they were doing. And the one person who stood up to them was Boris Yeltsin, who was at the time party leader in Moscow. And he stood on top of a tank in the central Moscow, and he rallied people around him. And in the end, the armed forces that they'd tried to send in to keep control of Moscow just sort of fizzled away. I mean, it just never happened. And then the plotters, after 3 days, they more or less lost their nerve, and the whole thing was over. Gorbachev made a triumphant return to Moscow. Didn't last long, I'm afraid. He was out of power within a few weeks, because Yeltsin was clearly the man of the moment.
Now, one person who has experienced a coup as it is happening is Catherine Filt, the Times' diplomatic correspondent. She was working as a journalist in Cambodia in 1997 when one half its government overthrew the other. This is what happened.
It was the 5th of July, I think, and the night before we'd been to a 4th of July party at the American embassy, which was quite leery. And so I think I might have had slightly thick head that morning. And something was happening in the streets of Phnom Penh. I think we got a phone call saying that, yeah, there were tanks by the airport. When we got outside, my boyfriend of the time and myself, we could see that there were people in the streets, just everyone was leaving their homes and sort of getting out of the city. And it sort of looked like something out of the film of The Killing Fields when everyone was deported from the city. People were getting out of the city because there were tanks in the streets and there was gunfire. And so still not really comprehending what was going on, we headed to the offices of the Cambodia Daily, which is where I worked at the time, and a newspaper in Phnom Penh, which was housed in a former brothel from the UN peacekeeping era. We headed there to meet our colleagues and try and figure out what was going on. And it would in fact turn out to be a coup where one side of the government was trying to oust the other, because it was a sort of power sharing. Imagine a really nasty breakdown between Nick Clegg and David Cameron. And
with added tanks.
With tanks. And that was what we were looking at. It wasn't your conventional coup where, you know, the military come in and try and get rid of someone. It was two sides of the same government, a coalition government, who went up against each other.
Wow. So you're in the office, in the old brothel, you're thinking, I mean, how does one even begin to cover a coup? Because then surely everything's in flux, including your ability to do your job, and everything is up in the air, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre. You know, so we sent teams out to do what they could. It was very difficult because, so for example, you know, that there were, the way you got around Phnom Penh at this time in 1997 was you would get on a moto taxi. So like it's a motorbike taxi. And obviously most of those were also either leaving the city or had gone undercover. So that was quite difficult. We were going out in sort of tag teams and just trying to find out what we could from the ground, and also calling people we knew in the military, in the government, and, you know, trying to get their accounts of what was happening. I remember calling one general who started to talk to me and then said, oh, wait, I've got to go. You know, someone's shooting at me. And I mean, it sounds farcical, but it was quite serious. And we ended up at one point with a gunfight going on along the street outside of our office, where there were, there was a tank at one end of it, and there were gunmen sort of behind trees in that street who were then taking pot shots at one another. And we ended up like getting, for some reason, there were mattresses in our office, and I don't know why that is. I'm pretty sure they weren't right back from the brothel days, but we were putting those up against the glass in the office to make sure that no stray bullets came in. And we essentially all moved into the office for a week because we really didn't have freedom of movement across the city. So we all stayed in the office for about a week.
Wow.
Wearing the same clothes. Yeah, pretty nasty.
And presumably when you're ringing your top contacts during a coup, you know, one, some of them are being shot at, but presumably you're ringing people who would otherwise be very, very high up within a government who are about as clueless as you are as to what's going to happen in the next hour, the next day, whether they'll still have jobs or indeed still be alive this time tomorrow.
Yeah, they didn't have much forward information, that's for sure. It was really more dynamic than that. We were trying to figure out what was just happening at the time. Yeah.
So how did the coup end, and what did that mean for you?
Yeah, so it ended with there were two prime ministers. This was the bizarre. I mean, you know, talk about an oxymoron. There was a first prime minister and a second prime minister. The first prime minister was also a prince. Again, you couldn't make this stuff up. Prince Ranarid. And the second prime minister was Hun Sen. And this was a power sharing agreement that had come about because the UN brokered elections had brought the royalist party to power, and Hun Sen sort of couldn't handle that. And so they had to kind of broker something. So he managed to kick out Prince Ranarid, who then fled overseas. He took control of the country and is still in charge today, all that time later. The coup sort of, it did kind of very abruptly end 3 days in. It actually came about very fast. And we were all slightly sort of left wondering what that was. And there was no consensus at the time about whether we could call it a coup or not, because it was one part of the government against another. So this bizarre euphemism arose in Phnom Penh, where we called it les événements, which I think was also used about les événements of 1968 in Paris. But that's what it became known until the UN conclusively called it a coup later that year. It was really, now we have a bit of perspective to look back on, it was really the beginning of the end for Cambodian democracy.
So there you have it. That is how you stage a coup. And now you know the most consequential in world history. You heard there from Dr. Mawiti Chacha from Birmingham University, Michael Binion, Catherine Phil, and Jane Flanagan from The Times. That's all we got time for on today's podcast. I'll be back tomorrow for my final podcast of the fortnight. You don't want to miss that. But in the meantime, make sure you like, share, subscribe, and follow wherever you get yours from.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.